because a lot of times you're doing more analysis than just splitting things 50-50. You're looking at tax impact, you're looking at liquidity, you're looking at the impact of different assets on a person's ability to retire and a person's ability to earn money currently. It wasn't clear from the books where the money had gone, what these entities were earning, and so...
You're listening to Afi Johnson Paris, an attorney specializing in family law. Welcome to the Fraud Fighter Podcast.
If I understand it, then I can think of creative ways to argue it and to present it. And the expert is a partner with me in doing that.
In this episode, how a forensic examination resulted in an additional $1 million settlement. How a divorce attorney finds outside help, such as forensic accountants and business evaluation experts. Why the expert witness needs to put in plain English the financial argument in court. And the value of articles, presentations, and being an expert witness in mock trials. She is a former Air Force captain. She is a graduate of the University of Virginia School of Law. She is also an attorney who was North Carolina Board Certified Family Law Specialist practicing in Greensboro, North Carolina. Afi Johnson Paris, welcome to the Fraud Fighter Podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Why did you choose law as a profession?
I was originally going into the Air Force, and I was going to be doing communication computer systems. But as a business major, you had to take a business law class. So I took the business law class, and it was just fascinating. It was the first time I'd ever taken anything where I would have taken it just for the purpose of being there. Didn't matter what grade I got. And so that got me interested in taking a class in my major for intellectual property. And it made me think, well, huh, maybe I want to, you know, do something with computers and law. So I applied to get a delay from going on active duty. The delay wasn't granted because they needed my services in the Air Force. And so I just went ahead and did my time in the Air Force and decided that, you know, when I got out, I was going to go to law school. And that's what I did.
What did you practice when you first got out of law school?
I started out with a large firm in Atlanta, and I was doing commercial mortgage-backed securities in the finance group of the law firm because I wanted to do transactional law only and didn't want to do anything with litigation. And it was like watching paint dry for me. I didn't care for it too much.
So later on, you transitioned to specializing in divorce. How did you make that leap from transactional law to divorce?
I tried the transactional law for a bit and just did not like it. And so I transitioned into the litigation group of that firm, and I was doing environmental law, which was sort of like a hybrid between litigation and some transactional work. And I didn't really care for that. So then I said, well, I'm going to go litigation all the way. So I transitioned into the litigation group in a firm here in Greensboro, and I was doing employment and real estate litigation and some bankruptcy. And finally, I just decided that law wasn't for me. I told my mom that nothing I did really mattered. The only thing I was doing was affecting which way the decimal point moved, and it wasn't enough. So I decided not to practice law at all. And during the time when I was looking for a non-law job, I got asked to assist with a family law case because of some pro bono work that I had done previously that was in the area of family law. And I worked on a custody case, and it just clicked. And that was the moment when I decided that, you know, this was what I wanted to do. And if I was going to practice law at all, it was going to be family law.
So when I hear the word family law, is that a kind word for divorce attorney, or is there a broader meaning than just divorce?
It's a broader meaning than divorce, because family law encompasses custody as well and child support. And many times the participants in those types of cases aren't even married. So it's a little bit broader than just divorce. And sometimes it's before people even get married, with like prenuptial agreements or things like that.
And so now you specialize particularly in family law. What are you seeing I could probably guess the answer to this, the most common reason for divorces.
You know, before I practiced family law, I would have guessed that it would be infidelity. And I think actually that comes a little farther down on the list. What I most often encounter is a lot of times it's neglect of a relationship. People have, you know, just gotten busy living lives and haven't given any attention to their marriage in terms of their relationship. And so they grow apart. Many times, many, many times, mental health and substance abuse issues come in play. And that will lead to divorce. Finances a lot of times too. And then sometimes it's just a difference in vision. Like, you know, the way they see parenting or the way they see money or, you know, just a difference in fundamental vision of how they think life should go.
I would think that most of the time when there's a contentious divorce, it's about child. Number one, and then about the money, probably number two. Would that be a fair statement?
I would actually say, yeah. I have seen people much more willing to settle and resolve over monetary issues than they are over issues of child custody. If I had to rank the cases that I have that actually go to trial, my child custody cases are number one. Almost all of my equitable distribution cases settle.
If there is a high net worth or a high income client, what steps do you take to ensure that your client's getting his or her fair share, particularly maybe the divorce proceedings? What steps do you take?
So most of the time, well, I always want to find out what's most important to clients. And so that can certainly impact what you're fighting for and where you pay attention to things. But if their assets are substantial or complex, I typically like to bring in a divorce financial planner to help me, because a lot of times you're doing more analysis than just splitting things 50-50. You're looking at tax impact. You're looking at liquidity. You're looking at the impact of different assets on a person's ability to retire and a person's ability to earn money currently. So a lot of times the divorce financial planner is helpful in those types of cases where it's more than just 401k and a house to divide.
When you say divorce financial planner, is that like a certification or is that like an occupation? Is it like a CPA? What does that mean?
So there are some financial planners and some CPAs who've taken the additional step of getting certified as a divorce financial planner. And so I'm specifically speaking to them. I mean, I've worked with general CPAs, and on easier cases, I may work with an accountant or a CPA to get things done. But I find that people who have specific expertise in divorce and have seen multiple cases and thought of creative ways to divide things or to make things happen are more beneficial when I have a high net worth case or case with more assets.
A divorce financial planner is a certification, evidently, that someone can get that says,
yeah,
hey, I'm certified. At least they've passed a test that they know what they're talking about.
Right, right.
When do you hire outside help, or what help do you typically hire out? You talk about the divorce financial planner. Have you ever came across a situation where the assets are being hidden and you have to find out where the money went to or the disposition of it?
Yeah, I had one case that I represented the spouse of a person who was in the sports and entertainment industry and had their main activity where their money was earned, but then they had all of these businesses, like different types of businesses, some related to their main activity, some unrelated, but it wasn't clear from the books where the money had gone, what these entities were earning. And so in that particular instance, I did hire a certified divorce financial planner, but I also hired a woman who had experience not only in forensic accounting, but business valuations to really help us get a clearer picture of what we were looking at and what documents we needed to be asking for that may tell us more than just the tax return would.
When you are hiring these people out or searching for them, I'm assuming you don't look through the yellow pages. That's old school. Do you Google this? No. Do you call it a divorce attorney? How do you find these people that you need help?
Well, a lot of times it's by referral. We have a very robust family law listserv. Sometimes I'll put out an email on the listserv asking other attorneys. Many times these are people who have presented to lawyers at our continuing legal education classes. So they may be vendors there, and sometimes they've been speakers there. And so that's generally the way I start. Sometimes I will Google, but you've got to have a slamming website and exceptional credentials for me to just pluck you off of a Google page. I'm typically going to want someone to vouch for you.
If someone who's a forensic accountant out there, or a fraud examiner, or a divorce financial planner, who wants to get into the realm of family law and help attorneys like yourself out, what would you recommend for them to do to get your attention or to get your business? How would they market themselves to you?
Yeah, you display your expertise. And I think one of the best ways to do that is to provide content, articles on the internet, articles targeting publications that target lawyers, presenting for lawyers, being a vendor at conferences for lawyers, being expert witnesses in mock trial situations. I'm an instructor at the Family Law Trial Advocacy Institute that is put on yearly by the ABA Family Law Section and the National Institute of Trial Advocacy. And one portion of that particular week-long class is that we have business valuators and financial professionals from around the country come in and volunteer to be our expert witnesses for the portion of the mock trial that deals with the business valuation. And so that's one way that I've met people that I have used. So just getting in front of lawyers to show your expertise. And the other thing is clients. Like if you have an accounting client or a client that you've worked with and you recognize that they're headed for trouble, being a good partner to them and assisting them as they work with their lawyers, sometimes I go back to those people because I've worked with them on cases before.
Going back to the mock trial that you were discussing, is this something where a set of facts is given to the business valuator or the forensic accountant and say, you know, here's a set of facts, now get on the witness stand and discuss it? Is that how that works?
Exactly. There is a case study that's presented and lawyers prepare it, but one of the business valuators also, you know, she puts together that part of the whole case study. It's got financials and everything, and they go through in the class part of it explaining how a business valuation is done, the basic elements, how to work with an expert, what questions you should be asking them. And all of these people who volunteer have been expert witnesses before. And so they sort of explain to you how to engage with this person. And then when we're preparing for the trial, the person who's assigned to be your expert witness will work with you just like an expert witness would in a real situation to sort of help you understand the material, help you understand the arguments and the best way to present it and questions that you ask them and the answers that you might get. And so that whole experience opens up lawyers to understanding how to use an expert, but also helps the experts know how to work with lawyers and then become later referral sources.
Other than a divorce financial planner designation, is there any other ones that you particularly look for, like CPA or CFE or name your alphabet soup?
CPA, definitely. I look for that a lot. And I would say if I were going to use a forensic accountant, I mean, at a minimum, they would be a CPA. And then if, you know, they have that specialty and that training and being a forensic accountant, then if I'm looking for a testifying expert specifically, that's probably something I would want.
So when you hire outside professionals, what exactly are you looking for?
Well, besides their credentials and their experience, I'm looking for somebody who can help me better understand the issues in a case, somebody who can help me craft my argument and help me understand the arguments against my position, somebody who can sort of help me avoid pitfalls that they see just by virtue of their experience and expertise. And then particularly when I'm using someone in court, I'm looking for a translator, someone who can take, you know, this particular issue and speak about it in a way that the judge or the fact finder understands what the issue is and how they should rule, gives them that information. Because you have to understand, many of our judges, you know, don't come from financial backgrounds or backgrounds of dealing necessarily with these types of cases. They could have been a public defender before they became a judge. So you have to explain to this person, you know, the difference between revenue and income, you know, what these different tax impacts are. And somebody who can do it in such a way that they don't make the judge feel stupid, they make the judge feel smarter about making a decision and hopefully making a decision in my favor. So that's the important part, that translation.
In this situation, you would have someone to say, listen, here's the pros and cons of your case. Here's where we're weak and here's where we're strong. And that way, at least you can make a good argument or understand. You may not want to ask this question or go down this road because it's going to be worse for you than later on. Or maybe write the opposite. You may want to admit up front, you may not have a piece of the puzzle. That way, it kind of takes the sting out of it when the defense brings it up.
Exactly. Like in one case that I had, we were trying to trace the impact of different stock purchases that a client had made in an account during the course of the marriage. That type of thing could create marital property. And if you just looked at the numbers of the stock trades, you got one analysis. But what this financial expert said, well, hey, let's look at how the Standard & Poor's did during this time period and see if he did better or worse than the Standard & Poor's. And he actually ended up doing worse than the stock index. And so we were able to make the argument, well, what he did really didn't impact this account at all. And so it minimized the increase of marital property. And that just gave me another argument that I wouldn't have thought of and certainly wouldn't have had the tools to create that analysis without the financial expert.
And you were also talking about a person who can articulate the position in a way that has a teacher's heart, which is, in my opinion, very important to someone on the
yes.
stand, where everybody can understand, including of a jury, because many times a jury is not going to have any clue about the accounting side of things or tax side of things. They hire that stuff out. And
yep.
if you have to have a jury trial, you need to have someone who can articulate the point and speak their language in a
exactly.
sense.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, in family law cases, in most of our cases, it's a bench trial and it's tried to a judge. But you're right. I mean, you have to break it down and make it simple. And it makes me a better advocate. If I understand it, then I can think of creative ways to argue it and to present it. And the expert is a partner with me in doing that.
As a case where I was a witness and discussing some tax implications on a certain item, earned income tax credit, which is if you have too much money, you don't get it. If you don't have enough money, you don't get it. But if you have in the middle, a certain range, you get a higher refund. And I explained it to the jury in a sense where I said it's sort of like Goldilocks and the Three Bears. A little hot, a little cold. You got to have it just right. I could look at them and they're all nodding their heads. They got it. You know, they
yeah.
got it. And the prosecutor who was asking me the question later on after court says, I've never heard Goldilocks and the Three Bears actually entered into court, but good job. It's like, well, you know, hey.
Yeah, but I mean, that's what it is.
You got to learn how to sell.
Yeah. No, we as trial attorneys are storytellers and you have to make the story make sense. And so that's what a good expert will do is tell that story in a way that people can understand it or picture it or it makes sense and that move them to a certain result.
When you hire some outside help, they can give you an opinion, but just giving their opinion to you doesn't really carry much weight. The opinion from the judge is what carries weight. So they're going to have to testify sooner or later, will they not?
It depends. Sometimes I'll engage an expert just for our own information and our own purposes. Like, for example, not so much in the CPA realm, but like dealing with a value of a house. We may have agreed as parties to get one valuator and to have them value the house, But I may say, you know what, why don't we get our own valuation and see what that says, and we'll hold that in our back pocket and use that if need be. And so sometimes I do use experts more as advising me and not being an expert that I would use necessarily in court. Like I said, the majority of the equitable distribution cases settle, but if I know that a case has the possibility of going to court, a lot of times if I'm looking for a very detailed analysis, I'm going to want an expert who could do double duty and not just advise me in the negotiation phase, but could also be somebody who would go to court. And a lot of times I will ask that up front, because I know I've had the experience with mental health professionals is that they're happy to advise and give you information on a case, and then sometimes they're surprised when you say, okay, now I need you to get up and testify. I don't want to say this in court. No, you're going to be more valuable as an expert or as a professional who helps me if I can use you in both places.
We talk about the planning and the tax angle and the valuation angle. Is this something that's always in family law practitioners like yourself forefront in their mind, or is this something that needs to be marketed to them? And the reason why I ask that is I've been around for years in this business, and many times there is an element where it's like a divorce attorney's like cars. You can get the expensive one or you can get the real cheap one. They may get you where you need to go, but sometimes you may break down on the way over there. I mean, it's just it appears that sometimes they miss, divorce attorneys in particular, miss some elements of things like the tax angle on it. Is this something that's pushed, or is this something that you just learn as you go?
It's in the statutes for equitable distribution that one of the things that the court can consider is tax impact. But I will find that sometimes in family law, you have dabblers, people who do, you know, a little bit of this and a little bit of that. So they oftentimes are not as adept as picking out these issues. And so I think when you start looking at board certified specialists or people who only do family law and they've done it for a long time, they're going to be more likely to understand and appreciate the tax impact. But you also have to understand that, you know, the average case, well, it depends on the lawyer. If your average case is going to be two professionals with a home and maybe each of them has a 401k and you're not talking about complex assets, then that is the type of thing that, like, a family lawyer who has experience or may have some type of financial background, or like, you know, like I have an MBA, somebody who has enough experience may be able to do that on their own. But if you're looking at lawyers who have more clients who are in upper income brackets, or they have, you know, not just a 401k, but they have stock options, or maybe they have a business, or, you know, an interest in a business or something like that, or a partnership, those people are going to be more likely to appreciate and need the additional expertise that these outside professionals can provide. Like, I know what I don't know. So when you start talking about dividing more complex assets, I know enough to know that there's a tax impact and we want to be careful about how we do that. So that's when I'm like, let me bring somebody else in to give a second look at this to help. This is my initial analysis of it. Help me look at this in a way that is going to be more beneficial to my client. So it's going to be those types of family lawyers that you would want to target, because they're going to have clients who have those needs.
Have you ever had a situation where, and I'll just make this situation up, where the husband is a fraudster, he's hiding things, and the wife's side of it just does not have a clue, and you get in the middle of it, you find out there's problems? Have you ever come across that situation?
More often than not, I come across a situation where one of the spouses, most often the wife, just has no clue. You know, she depended on the bills to get paid. They got paid. She was good. That's what I see more often than not. The fraud piece, I don't see as often. Sometimes I've seen it a few times where there has not necessarily been some fraud, but some really creative reporting of income I guess you could call that fraud. So, you know, I think that comes up a lot when you have people who have businesses, family businesses, and, you know, they report this like crazy low income for multiple years, and the wife goes along with it. And then all of a sudden, you know, when they get divorced, you have to show what the income really was. And that's challenging because, you know, I'm like, well, look, you agreed to this tax return. You signed this tax return. You say that your husband only made $40,000 a year, but you guys have, what, $200,000 plus worth of write-offs or something like that, or, you know, all of these other things that the business has paid for. So that's when I really need an accountant to not just dig into the tax return, but to dig into the financials of the family to help us show what the income really was. That's the most often type of fraud that I see. In some respects, the spouse is often complicit in that type of fraud. That's what you see a lot. But what I tell people most often is, like, treat this like an algebra equation. You know, you come to me and you say that your spouse is hiding money, but you have a general idea what your expenses are. You have a general idea of what their income. And so we're going to be solving for X, that amount that you think they're hiding. You don't have lots of debt, or all of the expenses are being covered by this amount, then it could be hard to assume that there's extra. If you're basically living within your means and you have a general idea of what your spouse is making, then what is it that they're going to be hiding? Are we talking about a significant amount here that they could be hiding? I don't mean the, you know, the extra bank account that they're putting $100 a month in. Because at some point there's a cost-benefit analysis of how much do I want to pay an expert to dig to find this hidden $2,000.
Right, right. There is definitely a cost-benefit analysis to hire an outside expert to find that information. Yeah, and exactly. It's not even guaranteed, which is kind of sad because, I mean, you may spend a couple thousand, $10,000, it depends on the amount, and you find out, hey, Miss Family Law Attorney, I didn't find it. And here's my bill. That's tough.
Well, I've had that happen. I had a client who swore her husband was, you know, hiding bank accounts and hiding money. And so we sent out all these subpoenas to banks that she thought he had accounts at. And what we got back, I mean, was not commensurate with what we spent in those subpoenas. Because sometimes, I mean, like USAA charged us like $1,800 to get back bank statements. He has a job that doesn't have like a lot of bonuses or a lot of cash. You know, he's an employee. He gets paid. So there's only a finite amount that you're really talking about with what he could possibly be hiding, because you know what his income is generally.
A W-2 employee has a hard time hiding his income versus
exactly.
A construction worker who actually is self-employed.
Yes, or a barber, or a restaurant owner. Yet people who have their own businesses have more opportunity, I would say, to hide. But most of the people that I deal with do have those regular old W-2 jobs, as I call them. And so when spouses come to me and say that person is hiding something, that's when I use my algebra equation analogy. It's like, okay, let's solve for X here and see if this really makes sense.
Can you give me a story of a time where you had a client that was defrauded and you solved it for them and it was a good outcome?
Yeah, I'm going to say it would be the situation where I had the spouse of the person who was in the sports and entertainment industry. I had my certified divorce financial planner and the business valuator tell me everything I needed to request. And we requested documents upon documents, and they were able to like really pour through those and say, there's a stream of money here. We can't figure out where this went. There's a stream of money here. And to just sort of like really piece together a picture, not necessarily down to the dime, but certainly broader than what we believed the income was. And so using that information coupled with picking the right mediator, a mediator who was really adept at finance and businesses and things like that, and using that information in conjunction with that, we got my client substantially more. I'm talking from maybe $1.5 million to $3 million.
That's a good one.
Yeah, because of that digging where we were able to uncover that and able to say, look, this is what we think we know. We can keep going. So let's settle here.
Right, exactly.
And my client was happy with that.
Are there any resources or training that have helped you on your journey in family law?
Oh, absolutely. The continuing legal education classes that the North Carolina Bar Association puts on have been profoundly helpful, from the basics of family law class that I took to the intensive ones that they do for family law specialists and people who've been practicing over 15 years. Those types of classes help. Actually being on the faculty of that Family Law Trial Advocacy Institute, you know, I did it as a student, and that's where I got the basics of business valuation and that type of analysis. And then to come back as an instructor and to see it over and over and over again has been really helpful. I think a lot of times I volunteer to teach continuing legal education classes, and that helps me a lot because you have to know it to teach it. And so it just makes me buckle down and learn it. So the CLEs are helpful. And then I also read the blog posts that the Family Law Section puts out. They'll do snippets or summaries of different courts of appeals and Supreme Court cases, rulings that come out. And that just sort of helps you keep abreast of, you know, the new terms of law so that you stay up to date.
What do you wish you had known before you started in the family law?
I wish I had known not to be afraid of court. The whole reason why I started out as a transactional attorney is because I had this fear of what it meant to be a trial lawyer, and I shouldn't have been afraid. I think I would have found family law sooner, if perhaps, but I wouldn't trade my journey, because certainly so much of what I do as a family law attorney is deal work, closing deals, and that's what I did as a transactional attorney. So that same work ethic and thought process and analysis and attention to detail that comes from the transactional side is still helpful today. Maybe I just would have found my way to family law a little sooner.
For the public, it's probably hard to understand that in general, lawyers don't even go to court.
Yeah, most of them don't.
I know some lawyers out there that would die just to have a trial, just so they could just be in there. I know. Everything's settled.
Oh, almost always. And even when I, you know, switched from transactional to litigation in the beginning, I just could not get into court. It's like everything would settle. And the only cases that I went to court for, you know, looking back, were the family law pro bono cases. Yeah, the pro bono cases. Those, I went to court for those. And thinking back to it, there's so many things in my background and my past that make me well suited for family law. But I just didn't really think about applying what I like to do and what makes me happy to the area of law that I chose. If I had been more introspective about that, I think I would have found my way here a little bit sooner.
And if you watch TV, it's nothing like it.
Oh my God, nothing at all. Nothing at all. You know, and I have to tell clients that getting them ready for court, I'm like, you know, it's not like you see on TV where you've got like a courtroom full of people listening in. I'm like, normally it's just us in here. The people who need to be, it's definitely not as exciting as it is. In North Carolina, attorneys have to sit when they're questioning the witness. So you're not going to have someone up in your face saying you can't handle the truth. It's not like that at all.
You ready for the final four questions?
Sure.
All right, final four. What is your biggest motivation now?
Hands down, my family, more so than ever. My children. I've got children, two in high school, a freshman, my son, and my daughter is a junior. I see the light at the end of the tunnel when it comes to, you know, this part of parenting. And I just want to provide for them and do well for them. So that's right now, you know, every day, what keeps me going.
It's tough to balance a full-time career and be a full-time parent and be engaged.
Oh my God.
Yes.
It's very hard.
It's very tough.
And even now in this whole age of remote learning, I'm just like, if I had little kids right now that I had to teach, I'd probably be somewhere in a corner crying. It's hard enough with high schoolers to make it during this time.
What book or books have changed your life or thinking?
I would have to say How to Win Friends and Influence People by Dale Carnegie. My dad made me read that book when I was probably in middle school. So not that I remember everything from it or anything like that, but just the title in itself, I think, expresses the importance of networking and engagement on your life and on your career. And those principles, I think, are important to my success and my abilities, is just remembering that book. So that's an oldie but goodie.
Share something that you've purchased in the last 12 months, less than $100 now, that you enjoyed or made your job easier, that if it's good enough for, you know, Afi, it's good enough for me.
I'm going to say it's my headset. My old headset had broken, and I didn't have one for the longest time. And I just would like to say, can you hold on while I put you on speakerphone? And that got just to be so old. And so my life is so much easier being able to type and write and maneuver. So it was worth every penny. And it wasn't. If it's over 100, it wasn't much more.
If you had to do something else, if you were fired today, what would you be doing?
I would love to be a philanthropist. I want to lead a foundation. I have a colleague who is leading the foundation for a national food chain, and he's like their corporate responsibility officer. And the day he got that job, I printed out his LinkedIn announcement, and I folded it up and I pinned it to my bulletin board right under my little sign that says, you cannot be tomorrow what you are not becoming today. I'm working on that through my volunteer work, but one day I would love to do something like that.
To be in control of $1 billion and learn how to just give it away.
Yeah, I think the whole motivation for me to move to family law was being able to be engaged with people and make a difference, because I felt like what I was doing before, like I said, only moved the decimal point and I wasn't making a difference. But to have the power of that type of money to make people's lives better and to study it and really, you know, be able to do something about it, that would really make my heart sing.
Well, Afi, thank you so much for your time on the podcast. I really do appreciate it. And best wishes for you and your family law practice.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate your time.
It's been a pleasure.